I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Judah Best. He's a retired attorney. He's a member of the board of directors at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. And tonight at 6 o'clock, he is giving a talk called The Mystery of Art Theft at the Museum Education Annex on Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe. And it's all about, well, art theft, which is one of your specialties. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Art theft, I mean, one of the things that's extraordinary, and you are giving a presentation where you're showing a lot of these artworks that have been stolen, some of them never recovered. It's extraordinary that so many famous, incredibly valuable paintings are vulnerable to theft. Why is that?
Well, for a whole lot of reasons, one of which is they're attractive in their own right. The second reason is that thieves think they can make an enormous amount of money out of a painting that's estimated at a worth of $100 million. And the third reason is the security at museums, at least in the past, has been, shall we say, deficient.
Who are the clients for what are obviously stolen goods? I mean, a stolen wristwatch is one thing because there's a gazillion of them, but a stolen painting, it's obvious that it's stolen.
Well, it's not obvious necessarily. Take the case of Steven Spielberg. I don't know if you knew this, but both Lucas and Spielberg are ardent collectors of the work of Norman Rockwell. And they go out and they get the most extravagant paintings. In fact, they just had an exhibition at the Smithsonian American Art Museum of their Norman Rockwell collections. Well, apparently, Steven Spielberg's staff did not do their background research, because if they had, they would have found out that the painting that he acquired, Russian Schoolroom, was a stolen painting. And it only occurred after the publicity of his purchase of the painting got out into the world, and a dealer in another city said, "Hey, that's my painting. It's been stolen for 6 years." And of course, he gave it back to them, to the rightful owner, and the gallery that had sold him the painting quickly made amends by getting him yet another Norman Rockwell. But it can happen anywhere, and it doesn't have to be a celebrated person like Steven Spielberg.
But then again, there are paintings by Vermeer. Now, I think there's only like 30 or 32 paintings by Vermeer in the world. One of them was stolen from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. I remember when that happened. It was such a terrible shock to everybody. Whoever buys Vermeer knows they're getting stolen goods.
Well, the point is that they don't buy them. Nobody will buy them. You can't steal a Rembrandt and expect if you go out to the market and say, "Hey, would you like to buy a Rembrandt?" Because everybody knows that there's something circumspect about the background of the painting. So what do they do with it?
That's what I'm asking.
Ransom. They're held for ransom. That's what happens. What will traditionally happen, obviously this is a general case, what will traditionally happen is that the painting will be lifted from a museum, and several days later a call will be made to the director of the museum saying, "I have your Rembrandt, I have your Vermeer, and I'm going to give it back to you for $100,000, for $50,000, whatever number." And then a negotiation begins in some cases, or in others. By that point, the museum, if they're on their toes, have called in the FBI in the United States or comparable organizations in other countries, and then the attempt at ransom is managed. Now, the most interesting case is probably that of the two Turners. Two Turners were stolen in Frankfurt. They had been loaned by the Tate Museum to a gallery in Frankfurt that was doing a special show showing the relationship between the works of Turner and the philosophies of Goethe. And during the night, someone, as some typically happens, someone overstayed the closing of the museum and hid. And
which I guess is probably not that hard to do in museums. There's a gazillion potential hiding places.
In some museums, although you have to understand that one of the tasks of museum staff, the guards, is to search out the galleries that they're responsible for before they close out in the evening.
Yeah.
In any event, these Turners were stolen, and over a period of 8 years of arduous negotiation, one and then another of them was ransomed, paid for by the insurance companies, because, of course, the insurance companies are on the line for the full price of a Turner, and rather than pay $25 million for a Turner, they would much rather pay $100,000.
So really, art thefts in these cases are more like kidnapping than like theft.
They range all over the field and all over the centuries, and then they've changed. Sometimes they're teenagers who steal the paintings, fledgling thieves, you might say, and they have no idea how to go about what they're going to do with it. They steal the paintings for the rush of the steal. And so you have a case like that. You have the Isabella Gardner theft, $300 million in paintings.
And those weren't ransomed. Those are still missing.
No, I never heard from anybody.
And I for some reason, for whatever reason, that particular painting and those paintings that were stolen for that museum, which I used to go to all the time when I lived in Boston, it's painful. And you think, that it exists somewhere.
Well,
it's sitting in somebody's vault that they paid untold money for.
Well, that's one theory. That's one theory. The theory of the rich, unscrupulous collector who is prepared to consign his request to a thief and pays the thief handsomely and puts the paintings in a second basement collection gallery that he has. That's sort of a romantic notion. It could have happened in this case, but the amount of money that would have been involved was extraordinary. In fact, it's more likely that there's somewhere in Massachusetts, in an attic of an abandoned house, are several trunks, and in those trunks are those paintings, slowly beginning to deteriorate because of the lack of adequate temperature or too much moisture or the like.
But why did they steal them?
For the rush.
Just for the steal of Vermeer for the rush.
No, it may be. I'm being too quick. It may be that they had some fanciful idea of securing a ransom or selling it, but got frightened off by the enormous publicity and the extensive manhunt that the police set up in that case. You add to it the fact that, you know, at that time, at the time of the Gardner heist...
That was 1990.
1990, the FBI was not involved, at least at the start, because it was only after the Gardner theft that Congress passed legislation making such thefts a federal crime. Up till that point, local police would handle matters, and the FBI could come in only if there was definite proof that the paintings had been moved in interstate commerce. But until that time, it was a local matter.
Oh, boy.
Well, that is not to say that local polices aren't good about it. As a matter of fact, particularly New York and Los Angeles have crack forces to cover art crimes. In Los Angeles, for example, there was a fascinating theft. I suppose I shouldn't use the word fascinating, but there was an extraordinary painting by a master painter from Sweden, a Swedish impressionist. And it was owned by this man and woman and hung in their house in a conspicuous place. And their butler, It sounds odd that I'm talking about the butler.
The
butler did it. He was going to leave and go back to Sweden where he came from, and he saw this painting, which was of a major Swedish impressionist. And what he did was, while the owners of the house were away, took the painting out of the frame and took it to a photographer and had a digital picture made, which was very difficult to tell the difference. And he hung the digital photograph in the frame, announced that he was leaving, rolled up the painting, and took off to Sweden.
Put it in a tube, put it in his check-in luggage.
Probably that's what he did.
Oh, my goodness.
And the lady of the house came home, and after several days, she kept looking at the painting out of the corner of her eye, and something about it wasn't right, and finally she went up to it, and then she realized it was a photograph. Well, she put it in the hands of the Los Angeles police. Within a relatively short period of time, it was found, because there's a database, and I'll talk to you about the database in a minute. It was found through the database as being set up to be auctioned in Sweden at an art auction gallery, and it was recovered and returned through the efforts of the police department.
Now, art thieves, who, as we can talk about, are sometimes part of pretty serious evil mafias, do they get punished severely do they do serious jail time?
I think they certainly do jail time. First of all, let me take issue with your statement that they're part of a organized crime unit. They may be, but the experience has been that these are sometimes one or two robbers who have no relationship with any organized crime, and they just go about it for the allure of the stealing of a major painting.
Well, Sandy Nairn, who's the director of the Tate that lost those two Turners and eventually they were recovered, talks in his book a little bit about the relationship to organized crime and to drugs and violence and all those kinds of things that sometimes art thieves are deeply involved with.
I think it runs the spectrum of everything from a simple house painter who decides to steal a painting on up to a highly organized criminal organization.
So do they end up serving time in jail and
yes,
things
they do.
Like that?
Yes, they do.
And do they get harsh sentences? And what happens when they come out?
Well, I don't know.
Do you have art theft recidivism?
I'm trying to think of a situation in which a criminal who has been prosecuted and convicted of art crime comes out and resumes his career. I'm not able to think of one. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I just can't think of it.
We're talking to Judd Best, who is giving a lecture tonight called The Mystery of Art Theft. It's at 6 o'clock at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex on Grant Avenue. So let's talk for a moment about the detectives who specialize in art theft. Are there people, in the FBI, in police departments, privately, who do this?
As a result of the passage of the Gardner legislation, federal legislation, the FBI set up a special 13-man task force known as the Art Crime Team. And they are very specialized, and they are very competent. One of their members is now retired and is actually in the commercial business of protecting against art crime. They have capacities that a normal police department, which does not have a specialized team, they have a capacity to negotiate, investigate, and assist the museum in determining the identity of the thieves.
I would think if I were going to be an art thief, I would try to get a job as a museum guard and figure out how the systems worked and what their vulnerabilities were and things like that. Do they screen museum guards, and is that a problem?
Most museums will screen their guards because it's almost suicidal not to do so. You've got to do that. But the real thing for the future in guarding these immense collections, and really immense repositories of thought and art, is the use of radio frequency identification as part of the system. Now, up till now, it's been terribly expensive, but for example, in France, they've been using it at the regional museums for a number of years. I was in Nice about 4 years ago, and I went to the Beaux-Arts Museum, and there at the back of each of the paintings was this clunky box, which clearly to me indicated that it was an RFID device to determine if the painting was being moved or in some way injured. Of course, I almost got into trouble because I asked them what those devices were, and they said, "Why do you want to know?" And I had to explain to them that I had a professional interest in it. Now, as time has gone on, it's become less clunky. And indeed, there's something available today, which is really a monofilament, a single thread of activated wire, which they can place within the canvas in a very inconspicuous way. And
yeah, because I was going to say, if you were a thief and there was a clunky box, you'd pull the thing off and
You'd pull the thing off, or you'd cut it out of the frame. And that was one of the problems with the conspicuous unit. And the curators were just at arms at the thought of this painting being cut out of the frame, and they didn't want it.
Right.
More likely than not, they are cut out of the frame and rolled, because it's easier for a thief to take them down a ladder or whatever method that they're going to use to get out of the building. But today, the capacity is there. It is still not being employed by most museums. They're just getting into it. The larger museums are getting into it because the cost has been prohibitive. And there is also that concern of the curators that you're going to injure the masterpiece by putting this material on it. And that's going to pass. It's going to be a period of time until most museums will be using devices, monofilaments, or global positioning devices, which tell you at one time or another where the equipment is. Because, you know, in the daytime, most of the security devices are turned off, videos, cameras. They're on all the time. But during the day, you can have your RFID device working throughout and with someone monitoring it. And if there is any movement, then you know that something bad is happening.
If you have GPS on the painting, basically, somebody steals it, you just follow them to the location where it is, and you're done.
Yeah. The single caveat there is you've got to have a global system in place so that you can see it. But,
right.
Yeah, sure. That, I think, is the... Not only is it the future for prevention against art theft, but once it's advertised, once it's clear to the... If there is a criminal community, to the criminal community, that it's hopeless to take these paintings, then you're going to have a true peace with regard to the war between the museums and the criminals.
Because it will just simply serve as such a strong deterrent.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So there are paintings that you'll be showing tonight that have been recovered through processes that are really the stuff of thriller movies and You know, The Director of the Tape is an interesting book. I want to finish reading that book that he wrote about the stolen Turners. But he really warns against romanticizing art theft, which is done in the movies and done in books. And actually, it's a very ugly thing.
It's ugly and dreary and time-consuming. And the people are not particularly attractive on the other side. Let's put it that way.
But at the same time, that whole process of recovery, while it can take years, a lot of these paintings are recovered. Then they have to go through a restoration process because usually they're damaged.
Well, in the case of the monks painted The Scream twice.
Yeah.
And one of them was in the Munch Museum and the other was in the National Gallery. Both of them were stolen at separate times, and both of them were painted on cardboard. And as a result, they deteriorated rapidly. It took, they were both recovered. And the criminals were given hefty sentences. But it took about 2 years of conservation before either of the monks were placed on public display again.
You would think that somebody could just tell people whose future was to be a famous artist, paint on archival materials already.
Well, if one has a real sense of history, I suppose you can do that.
I'm just kidding, but it's amazing that such a valuable masterpiece is painted on such a vulnerable to deterioration material.
Well, Munch was a very original person, and the important thing is that people enjoy his work. He presented an advance over the prior art for Norway, and we treasure what he's left behind.
What about private collectors? I mean, you gave this example about the butler stealing the painting. I would think that private collectors who own valuable works of art, and Lord knows you go into any museum and there's a show of some artist and there are always some paintings from private collections. They're not all owned by museums. Do they have museum-level security in their houses? Are they required to do so by, presumably they have insurance, by the insurance companies?
Well, probably not. I think it will become more accessible as the development of RFID continues. It will become accessible down to the level of the individual collector. And the additional selling point for it, in addition to the fact that you'll preserve your painting, is that you'll reduce your insurance costs. Because the insurance companies aren't fools about it. What they'll do as an inducement to private collectors is have the as much security as possible. Once you have that security, they'll reduce the cost of the insurance.
Right. Now, these paintings that have not been recovered, there are Rembrandts, there's this Vermeer, there's other paintings that have never been recovered. Are there people who get up in the morning and work on trying to find them, or are they just cold cases?
Well, I believe that Anthony Amore, who was the head of security at the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum, not during the time of the theft, but afterwards, has dedicated his life to the recovery of that art. So there are people who are concerned on a daily basis what's happened to that art. What can I do today to recover it? And
what can they do?
They can keep their eyes and ears open. There is a criminal internet, if you will, of rumor and surmise and discussion. And if they learn something, they can act on that information. But admittedly, there's nothing else they can do.
Do they have undercover people posing as purchasers of that kind of thing, like the so-called secret rich collector hermit type?
I don't know. I have not penetrated to that level of sophistication into the criminal world. I look at it, just to remind everyone, I look at it from the outside.
Well, you're an attorney. What is and was your professional interest in art theft?
Well, first of all, I'm a collector. And second of all, I have had a general white-collar practice, and I could see that there was almost no sophistication and considerable confusion in the attempts to recover art. That is largely past. But it seemed to me, given the amount of attention that is paid in other fields with other property, that a little bit of the same sophistication on the professional side, on the police side, would do wonders in cutting back on crime in the museums and in the homes.
What would that look like?
That I think it would look like what the first view of heaven will look at like. It would be a situation in which thieves are so thoroughly discouraged about the likelihood of success of actually stealing the work, or if stolen, the lack of success in selling the paintings, that they will go on to more profitable fields.
They will go on to become teachers, dentists, and plumbers.
And some are. I did this lecture on several occasions in several cities, so I'm going to hide the name of the person involved, but a fellow came up to me after the show and said, I used to be a burglar, and now I'm out of that business, and I'm going straight. And
really?
I said, well, that's great.
What profession did he go into, just out of curiosity?
I didn't ask.
Wow. Well, Judd Best is a retired attorney. He's a member of the board of directors of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. And tonight he will be giving a talk called The Mystery of Art Theft, complete with wonderful pictures of artworks, both still missing and recovered. It's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. For reservations, you can call 505-946-1039. Or online, you can go to okmuseum.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, you're entirely welcome.
I'm happy now to welcome back to the show Marcela Diaz. She is the executive director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido, which is an immigrants' rights organization here in New Mexico, and Marina Piña, who is an organizer. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having us once again.
My great pleasure, and of course, as anybody listening probably has already guessed, it's the beginning of the legislative session, and every year the same issue comes up over and over again, which is the question, well, actually, the last couple of years, the question's come up, which is the question of immigrant driver's licenses. This thing just won't go away. What's going on?
It won't go away, Mary Charlotte. It's the third attempt by this administration to take away the licenses of folks who live, work, and pay taxes in our state, taking a license not just from individuals, but really from their whole family, because, of course, we know that lots of U.S. citizen children depend on their parents and their ability to drive safely and insured and with registered vehicles. And so it's really unfortunate. We honestly believe from the work that we've been doing around the state, talking to legislators, talking to community members, that people are really tired of this issue, very fatigued. And so this is a 30-day session. We know that voters across the state and non-voters who are immigrants really want our legislators to tackle issues in relation to the economy, into job creation, job stability, education issues. These are the issues that they really want them to tackle. This is like low, low, low on people's priorities.
So what happened? There was some kind of program put in place temporarily involving immigrant licenses by the Martinez administration, but it bypassed the legislature. What was that all about?
Yes, obviously the state legislature did not come to any agreement on a repeal. The Senate wisely decided that it didn't make much sense to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and they put together an alternative proposal that would safeguard the public safety benefits that we have by making sure that immigrants, regardless of immigration status, are insured, register their vehicles, are in a law enforcement database, but at the same time cracking down on fraud and increasing residency requirements, requiring more renewals. That passed in the Senate, but it never got to the governor's desk because they couldn't come to an agreement with the House as to what to send to her desk. So that happened in the first session. In June of this last year, there was this big residency program, re-verification program, targeting 10,000 only foreign nationals. And, of course, MALDEF and a Albuquerque-based firm stepped in.
What's MALDEF?
The Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund, based out of San Antonio and out of California. And they protect the rights of Mexican-Americans and Latinos, and really, you know, the civil rights of everyone.
Right.
If we think about it in that way. And so that program, they sued because they said you can't discriminate against folks. And this, we knew that program was very costly, was inefficient, and was just meant to drum up evidence to use in the special session. But it was enjoined. There was a second lawsuit that was just filed last week by MALDEF and by the same Albuquerque-based firm, and it's a whistleblower lawsuit.
I read about that in the paper. Somebody was fired because she complained that she was required by motor vehicles to enforce discriminatory policies. She couldn't speak Spanish to Spanish-speaking people and things like that.
Yeah, asked to treat people disparately based on their national origin. So, you know, Mexicans were treated in one way, Canadians another. And so she saw some of these problems, from what I understand as well, from what I read in the paper and the press releases, and she was fired for complaining. So now, you know, that only corroborates what we've known to be true from folks in our community who've been saying that, you know, they're being asked to present more documents than required. You know, when it really comes down to it, there are lots of things that can be done in regulation and through administrative policy, legal things that help crack down on fraud, that help ensure that people are using good residency documents. We can improve residency requirements. In this last year, there has been no effort to actually do that by this administration. Instead, it's this continued sort of attack through the legislature. And I think it's pretty clear now, based on everything that we've been seeing in the press and what we've been hearing, that people know that this is just a part of a political agenda and not really about
public safety.
Yeah, good policy.
So just to do a little bit of history, the history of this immigrant driver's license law was that a bunch of immigrants, a large number of immigrants, eventually got together and basically lobbied for a law that would allow them to get driver's licenses. And amazingly enough, to the general public, this was very much supported by law enforcement, who liked the idea that people would have identification, and the insurance industry didn't seem to mind because there would be fewer uninsured drivers on the road and that kind of thing. So how has it panned out so far?
Well, we've seen about 90,000 individuals from New Mexico who live here, who pay taxes here and who work here, able to get licenses. That means everyone under the age of 25 without a social security number.
Have to take a test.
They DWI were able to take a DWI prevention exam as well as go through training. That means kids under the age of 18 in that graduated licensing system who don't have social security numbers have to show that they have no alcohol or drug-related offenses on their record. I mean, and that they've taken DWI training. It's a really good thing in our DWI prevention efforts to ensure that everyone is a part of those efforts, not just folks with social security numbers, especially if they're going to be driving anyway. It means that...
Have there been fewer DWIs? Is there a way to measure that, you know?
I mean, we've seen that, you know, there. I mean, it's again, we make up such a small... I mean, all of this for about 5% of our license database anyway.
Oh, okay. So basically most DWIs are American citizens with American citizen driver license.
Right, as is, yeah. And so we can't, it's very difficult to, when you're such a small percentage of the population as a whole, to have a big and significant impact on any rate.
Right, of course.
But what we can say is that, you know, why eject 90,000 people from this system of accountability. We understand, and we talk about driver's license is not as a as a right or as a privilege, but as a requirement that's imposed on all people who live in our state to ensure public safety. And so why exempt this important part of our community from that those mechanisms of accountability?
So we have about 90,000 people who are paying insurance, are registering their cars, and if they are taken away from the system, we still have to drive, right? But now we're going to have to do it without insurance, we're not going to have any kind of identification that it's helping also law enforcement.
We're talking to Marcela Diaz and Marina Pina from Somos Un Pueblo Unido. Marina, you are going around the state and talking to people and holding meetings. What's going on in outside of Santa Fe?
Exactly right. Like Marcela was saying about these discriminatory policies, this is the everyday story that we are told in these communities, not only in Santa Fe, but we go all around the state, and we have community meetings where entire families, with children, come to our meetings and tell us their stories and how is it, what is happening at local MVDs, but also the importance of having a driver license.
What is happening at their local MVDs?
Well, we have stories like we have to get a driver license. If you're an immigrant, you have to take an appointment, get an appointment. So most of the people who go through the appointment process, they don't get their driver license on the first appointment because for any little excuse, they are rejected from getting their driver licenses and they have to do several appointments to get them. We have members who already have like 8 appointments and cannot still get their driver licenses.
And these are people who live in our state. And so if people who actually live in our state and have documentation to prove it are having such a hard time, imagine people from outside of the state who aren't eligible to get a driver's license. So this whole notion that you can walk in, get a license, walk out without proving your identity, without proving your residency, and then go to another state and trade that driver's license is just false.
Is that what's being said as an excuse to cancel repeal the law?
We just heard once again last week.
That's one of the arguments.
the governor on television saying you can take New Mexico's driver's license and go to New York. She was saying these Pakistanis can fly to New Mexico, get a New Mexico driver's license in a day, go to New York, and trade their driver's license for a New York license.
Pakistanis? And what does Pakistan have to do with anything?
It seems irrational, I know.
Wait a minute. Is there a single documented case of a Pakistani person flying in and getting it? I mean, what are we talking about? Is this made up, or is it based on something that we might call evidence?
I mean, there is fraud. I mean, there's fraud not just in New Mexico, but there is fraud in every state, of course. And we as an organization and as a coalition of about 40 organizations do not support fraud, do not support people coming from other states to get licenses. But when you go on TV and say, there's so much fear-mongering in that statement, right, that someone's flying from a country that is obviously a part
overseas.
Of a larger discourse on terrorism and coming from overseas to get a license, it's disingenuous. And in fact, there are really strong policies in place and practices that have been put in place over a number of years to ensure the security of our driver's licenses. There are a number of security features on our driver's licenses. It doesn't mean that we can't do even better. And that's really, I think, what the legislature has really, they've signaled through the last, the regular session that they want to keep licenses for immigrants who live, work, and pay taxes in our state and crack down on the people coming from other states. Now, the other thing is you can't go to another state and trade our driver's licenses for another. There's no state that has that kind of lax requirement. Every state requires a number of documents to prove identity and residency in
your
state.
Yeah, I think you used to. When I moved here 20 years ago, I think I came with my Massachusetts driver's license.
And you just traded it.
Traded it in. They
that
punched a hole in the old one.
Anymore.
Yeah. And you kept the old one, right?
No, no. That doesn't happen anymore. And so if the governor were to actually look, as we have at every state's requirements to get a driver's license, she would learn that, in fact, it's a lot more difficult in every state to get a license, just as it is here.
So let's talk about the politics of the upcoming legislative session. The governor wants to get enough votes to repeal the driver's license law that allows undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses. What are you proposing? What is the mood in the legislature?
Well, I'm hopeful that legislators will listen to their constituents when their constituents are saying, these are the issues that are important to us.
What are the issues that are important to people?
The economy, job creation, job stability, making sure that we have a sound budget. I mean, these are the issues that immigrants and non-immigrants are interested in our legislative leaders tackling. Education. And, you know, we've seen polling that suggests that this driver's license, that doesn't suggest, that shows that, you know, far below, that the vast majority of folks do not think that this is an important issue. I think it was 1% of Hispanic voters thought that this was an issue.
The main priority.
One of their main priorities.
Yeah.
And I think it was 9.5% of sort of the voters in general who thought that this was, this should be a priority. And so the vast majority thought that and think, and that certainly, I mean, that makes sense. And it's not just, I mean, we've seen a number of polls that show that, you know, the economy and jobs really dominate voters' concerns. That makes a lot of sense. And so,
well, when you think about what affects your daily life, whether you have a job or not affects your daily life more than whether somebody down the street does or doesn't have a license.
Right, right. I mean, we've also seen polling that shows that, you know, 2/3 of New Mexicans voters, likely voters, support this Senate alternative proposal that continues to license immigrants. Regardless of immigration status, continues to require them to get licenses, but subjects them to additional residency requirements, more frequent renewals, and to additional penalties for fraud.
Does that mean instead of 8 appointments, they'll have 12 appointments?
Well, hopefully not. It just means that, you know, I mean, and right now it's, I mean, you can use, if you're a foreign national without a Social Security number, you can use your passport from another country, or you have to have either a passport from another country or a matricula consular from the Mexican consulate.
That's the ID.
At the minimum,
that's issued,
right?
By the Mexican consulate.
Right, but in addition to many other documents supporting those, but at the minimum, foreign nationals without socials have to have that. And those are verifiable documents. RMVD has the ability to, and does for these folks, to verify the authenticity of these identity documents with the issuing agencies. That's a pretty, most people don't know that we have that kind of secure system.
Right. Even to get a matricula consular, it's more difficult for the community to get a matricula consular, right? Because you have to prove that
your residency,
and also that you're actually, you know, from Mexico, so.
Or
it's
wherever
harder.
You're from. Yeah.
So we hope that, we're confident that, again, the legislators are fatigued by this issue, but we have to contact them. We are hosting not just Somos, several statewide organizations from around New Mexico are hosting a Immigrant Day of Action. We're coming, sharing our stories, really trying to hold our legislators accountable and really create that balanced discussion. You know, we're not talking about people from other countries. You know, we're not talking about terrorists, we're not talking about criminals. We're talking about people with families. Here they are. This is who I am. I'm not dangerous. You know, what do I do with my driver's license? I buy insurance, I register my vehicles, I go to court if I have a traffic ticket, I pay my tickets, I comply with the law. And that's really, those are the people we're trying to safeguard. We have a very broad and growing list of organizations that are a part of this coalition, the Coalition to End Against Domestic Violence, the League of Women Voters,
NAACP.
NAACP. It's you know, the social workers. I mean, you know, CWA. It's a long list of folks, plus, you know, all our faith communities and our civil rights organizations across, and immigrants' rights organizations across the state. So, again, and then, of course, there are law enforcement officials who come and talk at these hearings and have spoken at several hearings and have spoken out about how important a tool this is. To have folks who are not in other databases in our state database that's accessible.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that's the biggest one when I look at this whole issue. I mean, besides basic fairness and safety and the reality that this is a nation of immigrants, and we might as well get real with that, the fact that people who do speed or steal or whatever they do have an ID and are in a database, that's huge for law enforcement. I'm sure it's helped a lot.
Of course, it helps people who are, you know, I mean, that's obviously not the majority, but the few that are out there that are committing crimes, they're in a database and law enforcement can access the latest information. I mean, even national security experts have said that it makes no sense to take immigrants out of these state databases because they, in fact, MVD databases across the state, across the country, have the most recent and updated information on individuals who are living in our country. And their databases, the MVD databases, are more up to date than, you know, Department of Homeland Security databases or
right.
Bureau of the Bureau of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. So
probably,
you know,
the only thing more up to date is Facebook.
Besides the driver's license, right?
So the day of
action. I hear law enforcement's trying to use Facebook too.
I'm sure. I mean, let's just think about it. If you were an agency that was trying to collect intelligence, and you had this giant database where people were putting everything in themselves, mm-hmm. you'd probably try to use it. But that's another story. Let's talk about the day of action, which is tomorrow, Tuesday.
That's right.
Yes.
We have people coming from all around the state tomorrow, 24th, at 10 a.m. at the state capitol. For a rally, and hopefully you can join us.
Yeah, and we would, you know, get involved, go to our website. We've got a great website called DL News, Somos Un Pueblo Unido. .org/DL News. If you go to SomosUnPueblounido.org, we post the latest articles, information, fact sheets on driver's license. It is for us and for our community, it is a public safety issue, and that's important to all of us. And unfortunately, what we've seen with this repeated efforts is, I think that the administration is I think it's pretty clear to everyone now that it's not about the actual policy. It really is about the politics. And we just have to be really careful. Marina came back from one of these community meetings. I think, was it Lovington? And an individual who had lived here for about 8 or 9 years originally came from Arizona. And he was an immigrant. And he said, you know, back in the mid-90s in Arizona, you know, we were fine. You know, we didn't see all of this hostility towards immigrants. He said, and then all of a sudden, a lot of folks who were undocumented started getting letters in the mail from their MVD saying, if you don't have a social security number, you need to come in and turn your driver's license. He said, and then after, that's how it started. He said, and then after that,
14
we started.
14 years later.
You know, 14 years later, you see Senate Bill 1070. And so this, for
and
us.
And you see a prohibition on ethnic studies of any kind in the public schools in Tucson, Arizona.
That's right. And it's so we understand that this is a part of a larger political strategy to build a base and to build momentum on this wedge issue and to distract voters from some of the other issues. But we think New Mexico, we hope New Mexico is better than that.
And we've been doing better than that, right? We do not want to be the next Alabama. And hopefully we can save the soul of our state.
That's right.
Marina Piña and Marcela Diaz are with Somos Un Pueblo Unido. They are on the web at SomosUnPuebloUnido.org. And if you have any trouble finding that or spelling it, I will put it on my website and you can go straight to it, SantaFeRadioCafe.org. And you're on Facebook.
Yes.
Good.
Well, so who are you if you're not on Facebook?
Exactly.
I personally am not, but Somos is.
All right. Well, it's great to have you both, and we will keep up with this issue during the course of the 30-day session. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.